on the phone right now from, I'm going to guess, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is author Michael Perry. Is that where you are, Michael?
Pretty close, yes. I'm in the special suite at the Super 8 Motel in Waukesha.
Oh, in Waukesha. Yeah. That's what I said earlier, you know, you get to be a big shot, you get to hit all the big spots.
Yeah, I just cruise on past the Motel 6 now, boy.
You're right up to the Super 8.
Yeah.
You know, as I was waiting you on, I logged into your website, and my God, you're not going home for a while. This is a big tour.
No,
this is a long tour.
They're making me earn a living.
Darn them.
I'm sneaking home Sunday. I'm going to see my wife and my two little girls on Sunday, and then on Monday I'll take off again. Tomorrow I'm playing at, my band and I are playing at a county fair, and we're looking forward to that in a lot of ways, because the only real information they gave us is they said, well, you know, usually you send ahead and they give you a stage plot and the layout and everything, and what they said in this case was, well, first, there's a horse pull, and they said, and then when the horse pull's done, we'll haul your stage in. And they said they'd give us a couple outlets. So
it sounds to me like you're on the back of a 18-wheeler.
We're not going in blind, but I'd say we're going in fuzzy.
I was very fuzzy. And that's in a place, I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly. Is it in Gillette or Gillette?
Well, I've been saying Gillette, and then I ran into a couple of folks in there, and they're telling me it's Gillette.
Oh, Gillette.
It's the Econo County Fair, but it's in Gillette, Wisconsin. And I'll tell you, I've covered a lot of Wisconsin, but I don't believe I've ever been to Gillette, but we'll cross that off the list tomorrow.
Well,
another
thing on your bucket list that's gone.
That's right. Finally got to Gillette.
Yeah.
I just hope there's a place big enough there to park the gigantic tour bus I bought. Yeah,
right, the multi.
We couldn't land the Gulfstream up there, so had to refigure that.
Well, we should probably.
Yeah,
if people don't.
I'll be in Milwaukee.
If people don't know, if people don't know, you are just starting out on the book tour for your brand new book, which was just released on Tuesday, I believe it was, Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. And I believe we've probably talked after each of your books, and I got to tell you, I think you've done good on this one, Michael. This is my favorite so far.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you. Coming from you, that's almost meaningless. But I agree. People don't know this. I don't know how much history we should get into here, but I was friends with your brother for a long time, and you sound exactly like him on the phone. And I often am very disrespectful to you because I think you're your brother.
Well, that's all right. He does the same thing to me too. He's very disrespectful to me.
That was a wonderful compliment. You don't know. You turn them loose, and you don't know. I think one of the reasons this one might be good is that I was able to turn the lens outward a little more towards someone else.
Well,
kidding aside, I enjoyed that.
You do, because the Tom in the title is Tom Hartwick, who is a neighbor of yours where you live in Wisconsin, and one of those people that, you know, back in the day, Reader's Digest used to have a thing called a column, a feature, I should say, called one of the most unforgettable, or the most unforgettable person I've ever met, or character I've ever met, and certainly Tom Hartwick might classify in that regard, but it kind of, Tom and the things he does and the things he says also kind of become, I don't know if you intended this or that's just my interpretation, metaphors for a whole lot of things, not only in your lives, but in the lives of a whole lot of people. And I think that's what's made your books so very, very popular with people, is the stuff that touches you seems to touch a lot of people.
I hope so. You know, I write about a very specific place, and in this case, a very specific person. But the whole time I'm doing that, I try to have an imaginary reader on my shoulder who might be from Mississippi one day and California the next, and the city one day and the country the next. And you hope that somehow, even though you're writing very specifically about a place and a person, there's some sort of universal thing happening there. And that was kind of what I was shooting for. People will be the judge, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and you kind of hope also, particularly after you read it, that everybody gets to have a Tom Hartwick in their life at one point or another.
There's quite a few of them out there. Yeah. You know, part of it, there's a little bit of elegy there because his type of folk are getting thinner on the ground. But on the upside, it's fun now. I'm out on day four or three of the book tour here, and just the number of people who have come up and said, I got an uncle like that, my great-grandpa was like that, and there are also, let me be clear, the female equivalents of Tom Hartwig out there, too. And that's been fun because it's not, yes, they're getting thin on the ground, but they're not all gone, and people are noticing, so that's pretty neat, yeah.
Well, yeah. In advance of all the people that are going to buy the book and read it, tell our listeners a little bit about who Tom Hartwig is and how you came to know him.
Well, he's my neighbor, and part of my point of this book was to write from exactly that viewpoint. What can you learn from somebody just being their neighbor? And I quite specifically, and I get into this early in the book, I go to some lengths to point out this is not one of those I found the source of all knowledge books, and he's not my mentor, I'm not his acolyte, and I don't even have special privileges with him. I mean, he's a popular guy, and there's lots of people that know him better than I do, but the whole point was what you can learn from just being neighbors. And there is some personal backstory. He was very good to my wife and her sister when they were young and going through a tough family time. But I've only known Tom for about 7-8 years. And I've never gone to him and said, Tom, teach me.
Yeah.
Because the few times I've tried that, I wrote about that in the book, you get some pretty odd answers. But if you just hang out with him and just pay attention and listen, why then you start learning stuff. And he's an interesting guy. I call him a roughneck polymath. He can do a little bit of everything, and he's very well read. And his favorite hobby is building his own cannons.
Cannons, yeah.
Yeah, he's got a 300-pound cannon he likes to shoot. And as a matter of fact, if you go to sneezingcow.com, or even these days, because we're fancy, you can go to visitingtom.com. And there's the very top post on the news page is there's a video in there of him shooting his cannon, and it's well worth the price of YouTube admission. So that's part of what makes him interesting, but also part of what the book's about, or not even part, I think maybe the whole book is about trying to find equanimity, which is something I've always shot for. And my understanding of equanimity is it's how you find some peace and happiness even in the face of huge imperfections in yourself and in the world. And Tom's biggest battle is he lives, he's 82 years old, he slept under the same roof for all of those 82 years, and up until he was a man in his 30s, he lived on this little farm that was isolated and beautiful, a little creek running down past the barn there, and that's all he ever knew, and just very quiet. And then one day they blew an interstate through. Basically, it was going to go right through his barn. You got him to move it just enough so his barn is still standing, but you can stand in his silo and sit on a semi if you're of the mind to.
Huh.
And he went from living this very isolated life to having now, the latest count is 22,300 vehicles a day, 8.5 million a year coming right through his yard. And you can just imagine that this has been a nonstop disruption for over 50 years now. And you know, he'll go on an anti-government rant for you, and there's a couple.
Understandably so, I think.
And they're pretty entertaining. But he didn't quit living, and he isn't bitter. And he talks about why the interstate has had positive effects too. And most of all, he just continued to live this very engaged, full life with his wife. Now, well, they were in their 59th year when I was writing the book together. And, you know, he's got honeybees in the garden, and he's not milking cows anymore. He finally sold the cows at the age of 77, but he's working on his lathe. And the other thing is, you know, he's got a lathe there that he's proud to show you that the most recent patent on that lathe is 1918. And yet I was over there recently, and he was making parts for some guy's $350,000 computerized combine. So he's just a treat. And so the book is just kind of a year spent. Now and then I'd need something welded, or I'd take him a dozen eggs or some of our pork chops, or sometimes I'd forget my pork chops, and I write about that too, about what happens if you show up to have him do some welding, I'd agreed to pay him in pork chops, and after he got done, I realized I forgot my pork chops.
Not the only time that you forgot what you were going to pay him with, either.
No idea.
You got to work on that.
He pins you right to the wall.
As your friend said, you know, you're doing okay with the equanimity. It's the equilibrium you got to work on.
That's right. Yeah, that was my friend Melty. There's a quasi-famous bar in Eau Claire, Wisconsin called The Joint. The guy who runs it, his name's Melty, and he's full of wisdom. And, yeah, I was moping around one day and told him I was working on my equanimity, and he said, "Your equanimity's fine. It's your equilibrium that needs some work."
We're visiting with Michael Perry, the author of Visiting Tom. You know, it has struck me. Well, first of all, you know, talking about seeking wisdom, it seems to me that, you know, a lot of what your book is about is that that's available to us in a whole bunch of ways if we just slow down a little bit and take the time to listen rather than talk. And that kind of stuff comes to us. We don't have to be somebody's acolyte, or they don't have to be our mentor. It's out there for us. But the thing that's always struck me about your book is that they always seem to me about connection to people, certainly, maybe sometimes to things, but a lot of times to a place. And yet in this book, you say, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it, that connection... Well, here it is. You've been second-guessing the whole idea of place, and you call the idea of attachment as a confining indulgence. That seems to be a departure for you.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a departure, but it's an evolution, and it started with... So I wrote a book called Population 485. It came out 10 years ago, almost to the day, and it was all about a place that I love and feel absolutely centered in, still do, New Auburn, Wisconsin. That's where I was raised.
Nobbern,
you bet. And I went back there and I lived there for another 12 years as a grown-up, put that in scare quotes. And and then I wrote this book about how centered I was and how I loved that place. And then, unbeknownst to me, there were life changes ahead, and I wound up moving, not far, our little farm is only 40 minutes from New Auburn, but to a different place. And then I've discovered that I love that place too. I would still, I still feel the most centered when I'm in New Auburn. But then I've also spent time in other places in the world and felt pretty comfortable. And what I'm coming to is this idea that sense of place is good, but it can also sometimes cause us to hang in there for things we maybe should let go. And also the bit about the indulgence is just that sometimes I get going on sense of place and how, you know, oh, what a disruption to leave New Auburn for a farm outside the fire district. And then I realize there are just tens of thousands, if not millions, of people a day being marched from one place to another at the front end of a bulldozer or a rifle. And so to sit around pining about your sense of place is also an indulgence. Not at all rejecting it. And still, you know, I went up to New Auburn the other day for Jamboree days and spent some time in the beer tent with the one-eyed beagle and my old lady. And actually, it's the beer shed now. They've upgraded.
Oh, boy.
And I felt, you know, I couldn't have felt more at home. But then at the end of the night, I drove back to our farm, which has now been home for about 7 years, and where I had a daughter born in the old farmhouse there. And we have history there, and we may or may not be able to stay there. I write about that in Visiting Tom a little bit. And I'm starting to be okay with that.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's an evolving thing.
Is it the same evolution that you write about in terms of trying to get past pining for things that are irretrievably lost?
Yeah, that's an ongoing... Well, I almost said it's an ongoing battle, but I still love that feeling. I think I had some of that today. I went out for a run, and then I'm here in a motel a ways from home, and I was listening to some music, and there was a particular steel guitar note that made me wish it was 1972. And it's never going to be 1972 again. And yet, for just a moment, I was transported, and that's okay.
That's a good thing.
It's when you start wallowing in it, then you've got a problem, because we do have to move ahead.
Yeah, it does. That will throw the equilibrium off. Can you take a few minutes and read an excerpt from the book for us? I realize it's over. I didn't see the writer, by the way. I'm sorry. That anything over 2 minutes, you get paid a lot more money for.
Yeah, you sent me, people don't know, but you sent me an email asking me to read for 5 minutes, and I said it's very specific in my writer. I only read for 2.5 minutes, and then you got to start paying. But then I said I went and checked my sales, and I decided I could read for 5 minutes.
That's right.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I don't know how long it is, but I'll read the opening prologue paragraphs. That gives you an idea of who we're dealing with here. It takes me a minute now because I did a post today on my blog at sneezingcow.com about this is my this is the first book tour where I've had to use reading glasses.
Oh, boy. Welcome to our world.
So this is the prologue. If you're going to, are you still there, by the way?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, I got some sort of weird beep. So.
Oh, nope, we're here.
Might have been. I don't know if it was the phone or if it was just me. If you're going to visit Tom Hartwig, you'll have to drive past the cannon. Not just past it, but before it. The muzzle surveils you through the open door of his galvanized tin pole shed, poking from between a pair of manure spreaders and a homemade portable welder the size of a chest freezer. You'll be about 50 yards out when you first glimpse the artillery, and will thus have time to consider whether or not you wish to proceed directly into the field of fire. The cannon is not a lawn ornament. If you look to your left, well across the field and halfway up the hill to the tree line 200 yards distant, you will see a 4x8 sheet of white plywood with a red bullseye painted dead center. Upon closer study, you will note a pair of perforations in the plywood, one within the first ring of the bullseye, the other just outside it. The cannon is only moderately accurate, as evidenced by the number of significant divots and frayed saplings surrounding the plywood backstop. But if you care to stand up there and test the matter, you may first wish to note that when the cannonballs do hit their mark, they leave a ragged puncture through which an NFL lineman could easily stuff his fist. Tom never leaves the cannon loaded, but newcomers will nonetheless find it daunting to motor between the target and the menacing hollow eye. "It's tough," a salesman once told Tom, "to come up your driveway with that thing parked there." "Oh," said Tom, "I never shoot at anyone coming up the driveway." So he's a bit of a character. He's got a little showman in him. We did that video I mentioned that's up on the website of him shooting cannon. And I'd seen him shoot that cannon many times, and he shot it that day while we filmed it. And while the film crew was packing up, I said, "Tom, that thing... that really jumped. I've never seen it jump like that before." And he leaned over and said, "I put a little extra in there for those boys."
Well, there were a couple other things, I think, that, in fact, yeah, Tom says, well, although I always heard it the way you did it, or referenced in the book, too. When somebody's telling a story and you want to kind of, you're hoping to wrap them down, and then they give you the,
Yeah, he does that.
He does it with them.
Yeah. So he was in the hospital, and I kept thinking I ought to leave, and I'm trying to back out the door, and then there'd be a little bit of silence, and just when I think I was out, you go, "Nah," and then there's this one time. and so I wrote a little bit about that whole quirk which we have around here. When you're starting a conversation up, people will say, "Nah," and then, or they'll say, "Yeah," and then, yeah. And I was especially fascinated by when we say "nah," and then, because you're kind of saying no, but then you're giving yourself permission to start talking again.
Yeah, yeah.
It's some, a fun little quirk.
Some kind of a contradiction. Well, and you've had in your books, you mentioned on the, and when you host Big Top Chautauqua, which you are the radio host of, which also is on our station, but and I've used it for years. I don't remember who I got it from, my grandpa or who, but I never say, "Well, I guess it's time to leave." It's, "Well, I suppose."
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's that kind of, you breathe in at the same time, push away from the tango. "Well, I suppose."
But everybody it's knows funny. What you're talking about.
I think it's a pretty Midwestern thing, because I do that at a lot of readings, and I found that if I do it in Wisconsin, I get a nice big laugh.
Yeah.
And then if I do it in Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, I get a decent laugh. And then the further you get from Wisconsin, the laugh seems to tail off.
And then there's just these questioning looks.
Like, yeah, I think it's kind of a Scandinavian thing or something.
Well, I want to, as I say, I really, really enjoyed the book, and I wish you the best of luck with it. I want to thank you so much. And, you know, one of the things, again, that I like about reading your books is that kind of the same stuff that touches us all. And when I read about your wife, that, as you say, you came to the marriage thing a little late out of the gate, and your given daughter, Amy, and Jane, your birth daughter, you're a lucky man, Mike.
I'm very fortunate, and I hope that I recognize that adequately. Yeah, I'm very blessed in that regard. And right now, as we're talking, my wife is at home holding the ship together and running things. And I would be way behind if it wasn't for her.
Yeah, as we all would.
Although on a lighter note, I do have to say, some guy recently I was talking about being in a house where it's two daughters and a... I wrote that in the book, yeah. Two daughters and a wife, and some guy said, you don't have a family, you have a sorority.
You are badly outnumbered. Badly.
That's you can right. offer your opinion, but it's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be considered.
Yeah. They'll go, well, we could vote on it if you want. Yeah, I know. That's the point.
Well, again, thanks so much for taking time to be with us. It's always good to talk to you, and good luck with the tour, but most especially with the book.